All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuckinistas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Feeling a little better. It sounds like you can still hear a bit of a cold in my voice, but it did turn out to just be a cold. No COVID. I don't know. It doesn't seem that COVID has the stigma it once had, but in my recollection of having the COVID once, it was very exhausting and went on for longer than I wanted it to, and I was very tired. So I'm happy it's not that. Whatever I have did not go into my lungs. It stayed in my head. And yeah, I feel better. I'm not going to get ahead of myself. I think that's one of the problems when you get sick. You feel better one day, and then you're like, this is it. I'm going to go climb Everest. And then you get sick halfway up, and you get exhausted, and you take a nap, and you remain frozen there for the rest of time as people step over you. Look, everything's okay. Kind of have a great show today. I'm very excited about it. I get excited, but, you know, this is very specific. This kid, Billy Strings, I really didn't know much about him. I just learned about him within the last couple of years, but I imagine a lot of people did. I know he's been out there, but I think I saw him on a Instagram reel, just kind of, it might have been during the pandemic. He was just playing his guitar, and I was just listening to it and watching him play, and I was like, what the fuck is happening? What the fuck is this? And look, I like music. I listen to a lot of different types of music. I've done my time listening to a bit of bluegrass. I've got my share of Doc Watson records and Bob Wills records and Earl Scruggs records and your Earl Scruggs Experience or whatever that was with his kids and some of that older country stuff. I don't know all the names, and I've always been impressed with it. I mean, it's hard not to, you know, kind of get excited when you hear fast bluegrass music because there's such a skill set to it. It sounds so meticulous and complicated in a way, and it just kind of moves. But I mean, I don't go back to it a lot. I don't spend a lot of time in bluegrass head. But there was something about watching this guy, Billy Strings, where I was like, this guy's doing something with it. He's making it current. I don't even know how. Maybe it's just his presence. Maybe it's just his proficiency. Maybe it's his love of the music. But he's able to sort of somehow make it vital. Make it now. And he can play anything, this guy. But I recognized when I saw him, and not unlike other people, I certainly just didn't discover this guy, that he's a prodigy. He's inspired. And he loses himself in the music, and his fingers and mind and heart are all synced together somehow in a very rare way. And it's just amazing to me. And, you know, I saw him live only once outside of here in my studio, out here in the garage. I saw him at the Willie Nelson birthday party. And I remember having this feeling when I saw him there, that watching him play with Willie and then with the kids and with everyone else who was up there that night, that for those old timers, this must be some sort of hearkening back to the past when that, when that music was not new, but sort of happening for a new audience. Just to be with somebody this wizard-like is just a rare thing. It's a rare thing. When wizards happen. And this guy's definitely a wizard. And since then, I've listened to all his records and I've watched him perform, Black Sabbath songs and all kinds of different stuff. I mean, he can play anything. But there is something, positively unique and transcendent about this guy's playing. And, his life is, he's a very grounded guy. But yeah, I did something I haven't done in a long time with him, and I asked him to play because he brought his guitar with him. And I did, and don't worry, I didn't ask him if I could play with him. I'm not going to get in the way of that. I'm not going to insert myself in that way. But I just kind of double mic'd him with these mics, with these SM7s, these Shure mics that I use for voice. But we just stuck it after Tweety was in here and he did a song and just played into these mics. I used to use a separate mic back in the day. I should probably do that more often. But, you know, ultimately, you know, Billy just, he's like, of course, sure. And these guys who play music for life, who live it, you know, when I watch them just lock in and do it, I'm always amazed. Like I'm watching, you know, something, you know, totally magical. And it is. So look forward to that. He does a Doc Watson tune, I believe. It was pretty monumental. It's pretty exciting. Some dates here. I'm in Vancouver on Friday, June 21st at the Vogue Theater. Then I'm in Seattle on Saturday, June 22nd at the Moore Theater. I've rescheduled the rest of my summer dates. So get all the updates and ticket links at WTFpod.com/tour. Yeah, I mean, I was at Largo last night. And I feel like it was, I just did my last long set for a while because I'm heading to Vancouver to work on this show. I'll be back intermittently here to work on the podcast. Look, I want to mention that we don't really talk about a lot of current events on this show, but if that's what you're into, two former WTF guests got together to start a new podcast doing just that. It's called We Think It's Funny with Mark Schiff and Daniel LaBelle, Danny LaBelle. They look at what's going on in the world and try their best to find the funny in it, which we could all use, sure. They have a lot of other funny people come on to hash it out with them, and they do new episodes every Wednesday. You can get it on all podcast platforms, as well as YouTube and Instagram. Just look up We Think It's Funny, the podcast. Pleasant fellas, those fellas. I saw, last night I saw Bob Odenkirk at Largo. I did a show at Largo. It was very good. I also had this interesting feeling, a realization in reading some stuff and also wondering why I do certain things in terms of, you know, what I do on stage and what I do here on this mic. I definitely talk more in depth and about different things in my stage shows. Once I create a vibe with the audience, I talk about current events. And I talk about, you know, my life in a different way on stage than I do here. There's a momentum to this presentation. There's a momentum to who I am on these mics. I don't indulge in the same amount of space. And I don't indulge in the same conversations that I have on stage. And I started to think about this, how so many comics kind of, you know, make the audience retire their phones or hide their phones or turn off their phones or are managing phones and recordings and everything else. And I used to think it was because like they didn't want their material to be burned or put out in the world. But I think there's another component to it that's kind of interesting is that sometimes, you know, in the world we live in culturally, depending on, you know, what your, you know, what platforms have the most juice and who you are and what kind of juice you have, you know, sometimes you don't want to have that big a conversation where you have no control over the narrative and anything you say can be, you know, turned into garbage and added to some fucking dumpster fire that now, you know, has your name on the list. Your name's on the poster of the dumpster fire. And sometimes, you know, as a performer, you want the experience to be in the moment and you want to have that conversation with the audience in front of you, not with the whole fucking world through clickbait. It's not you don't have to do that, but you can speak your mind to your audience in a way that maybe it's fleeting, maybe it happens once, but, you know, if it's your audience that's come to see you live and you give them something to think about and they go out into the world with it, that's sort of what performance is about. Sometimes, you know, speaking on mics, on platforms, what happens is it's taken out of context, it's put into a different narrative, and then you're just, you know, dragged along by your neck or your feet or your hands, being dragged by it on someone else's terms. So it's sort of a breakthrough in to realize that it's not just about the material getting out in the world that you might want to do on a special or reserve, but it's really about autonomy and the experience you have with your audience only, which can't be underestimated. Yeah, it's funny. I saw Bob Odenkirk last night And I guess I've probably known Bob. The first time I met Bob is probably like 35 years ago. And it's so funny, man, because after talking about on stage last night, I don't even know if he heard me. It'd be funnier if he didn't. Just this idea that, you know, from the very beginning of me doing comedy, I always felt like I was, you know, a weirdo in that how I did it was, you know, off-putting and angry, and that, you know, I was, you know, different than everybody else, but not in a good way. And I started thinking about my whole life, about my friends, and about feeling like I was sort of a drag and too heavy and too sensitive, and, you know, how much effort it took to sort of like be friends with the people I wanted to be friends with. And just, it was just this whole perspective on myself of like how I kind of, you know, after years kind of wedged myself into the world of comedy finally through a podcast and just kind of kept pushing, you know, it didn't happen organically. I always felt like I was always pushing to be accepted and be liked and everything else. And, you know, I'm not saying I don't feel that way, but I think I've relaxed a bit. But I always felt like I was different, you know, and it was funny because Bob was there. He was doing a bit with his son, Nate. They do a funny kind of like Bob does a few characters and Nate does an interviewer. It's funny. Hey, Bob, you know, he's having a good time with his kids. His daughter is also an illustrator and they did a children's book and he's very involved with that. And I think he really gets a kick out of it. And the kids are great. But after, you know, they got done, you know, Bob came out and I was talking to him about when I first met him. And how, like, he always was this sort of, like, he always had this parental tone with me. I felt, you know, sort of like, I always felt like this sweaty, angry guy that would show up where they were. They were doing sketches and Mr. Show, and I was out there doing comedy and yelling. And I always felt that he was like, what's going on with you, Mark? Everything okay with you? How are you doing? What are you working on? And then his son from backstage goes, I know that tone. And I said to Bob, I said, do you know what I'm talking about? He goes, yeah, you just always, Bob says, you always acted like, you know, you weren't part of it. You weren't part of the community. And I'm like, what? He's like, you always were. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to get closure on this thing. But it's just so weird to know somebody that long. And now we're old guys, old-ish. And yeah. But also, you know, He said one of the funniest things, and I asked him if I could do it on the show last night. He said I could, so I guess I could share it with you. So when Bob had that heart attack, you know, back in 2021, he was in New Mexico. He was in Albuquerque, and where I grew up. And you know, it's a very weird thing when you get to a certain age, and you know, your fear kind of overtakes your empathy in moments. You know, like the great Steve Albini died. And it was sad. But then when I found out that he was 61, you know, I'm 60, man. And there's the sadness and the empathy for his family. But, you know, very quickly after it, it's like, how old? 61? Holy fuck, I'm dying. I could die any second. You know, these things kind of amplify that reality, the existential reality. But I remember when Bob had his heart attack and I knew he was in Albuquerque. And I just texted him, and it was one of the funniest text exchanges I've ever experienced. And one of the funniest things Bob has ever said. I just texted him, glad you're okay, scary, it's Marin. And Bob texted back, super scary, Mark. I basically died for a little while, and I have to say I saw nothing. But this great crew with some amazing people kept me going, and then the hospital did a great job with some challenging surgery. I hope you're doing great. I'm feeling good. Take care. And I said, glad my hometown hospital was there for you. Welcome back from the nothing. And then Bob said, big time, excellent docs and nurses at Presbyterian Hospital on the ball. I'm doing great. BTW, I saw exactly no light when I was, quote unquote, dead. That whole heaven thing is a hoax. Follow the money. He's very funny. Very funny and very sweet. A lot of the guys that were just champing at the bit for, you know, for the big grail of show business, he obviously got it. But all those years of ambition and competition and just driving away, a lot of times what happens on the other side of it, if you're lucky, is that you soften up a bit and you learn how to enjoy life and enjoy seeing your friends and it's just. It's a nice thing when people, you know, get a little uh, get a little softer as they get older. I think it's the I think it's the best thing that can happen. Okay, so look, Billy Strings is just a savant somehow, a real wizard. He's on tour right now through the summer. You can go check out billystrings.com for tour dates and tickets. And this is me talking to him, and I was very excited to talk to him. Well, this is pretty exciting for me.
I heard, you know.
You heard me, someone told you I was talking about you?
Yeah, well, I heard Les mentioned something on here.
Oh, Claypool, yeah.
Yeah, and then, I heard from my manager, hey, you know, you want to do this podcast, and it was like last year or something when I was knee deep and, you know, neck deep and tour. I kind of was at this point where I'm like, I'm not doing shit besides gigs.
Because
I was doing so many gigs. It's like, everything that came through, I said, no.
Yeah.
I was like, do you want to do this interview? No.
Oh, because you're only in town for a day, maybe 2 days. Then it's just like, we can't do anything else.
Yeah.
When you tour, is it like every night?
It's probably like 4 nights a week.
On a bus?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's everything. Jump on an airplane, fly out here, hop on the bus, drive through the night, play a gig. You know,
same guys.
Same band for sure. I've had the same guys for several years now.
Yeah, and what are you doing out here now?
I was finishing my record, actually.
New record,
yes, sir.
What's the angle? Anything different?
Well, this one I was working with John Bryan. He produced it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I know that guy. So you got him out of his house.
yeah, and so, I even got him to like walk around in the daytime.
Wow,
I know.
Did you get him to play piano?
I did a little. Yeah, he's such a great musician on every instrument.
It's kind of wild though. So like, what does he bring to it? How is he going to change it? Is it still like a would you call it a bluegrass record?
I mean, I don't know what to call any of my records, honestly, because there's some bluegrass on them, and that's where I cut my teeth and how I started. But I just kind of, when I'm writing, I just follow the songs.
And whatever comes.
Yeah. It might be a bluegrass song, or it might be more of a singer-songwriter thing, or have like an even heavy metal kind of influence peeking through, or, you know, stuff like that.
But so you don't label it?
Try not to. I mean, I grew up playing bluegrass, and that's, you know, I'm a bluegrass player, but my original music is not necessarily bluegrass.
Sure. It's kind of like, it's like Sturgill, you know, hard to categorize.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, you know, I would say a country
totally
act or a player, but he'll fucking go out there.
Yeah, he's steeped in that.
Yeah.
And he's a great country and bluegrass singer.
You know that guy?
Not very well.
That's interesting. I assume you all know each other.
No, I mean, I wish. You know, I think that too. It's like kind of when I started to get a little bit, you know, more like notoriety or something. I thought, oh man, this is gonna be cool. I'm gonna become friends with Tyler Childers and stuff. And just never really happened. I mean, it's like, he kind of just seems like he's hiding up in the holler somewhere.
Yeah.
And Sturgill, you know, there was when he was doing them bluegrass sessions. He had asked me to come. He said, man, we're gonna be recording tomorrow and the next day. Come on by if you want to lay something down on it. And I was so excited and, you know, honored to get the ask.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I could play on a Sturgill record. This would be amazing. But I had this camping trip already planned with some friends of mine where we were, you know, I mean, we had it planned and we were going to go camping and take some psychedelics and go float down the river. And, you know, and we ended up going fishing and stuff. And so I had to stick to that. And I told Sturgill, man, I'm sorry, but I already had this camping trip kind of planned.
Yeah.
And after that, I never really heard from him again until I ran into him on an airplane one day.
Yeah.
Which was...
And was he like, how was that trip?
No, I don't think he even, you know...
Registered it?
I don't think he even noticed. I think he probably threw it out there and...
How was that trip?
It was great, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was... that trip actually ignited this fire that had kind of died down in me a while back when I got so busy with music, which is fishing.
Fishing, yeah.
Big time. Yeah, and I used to do it a lot when I was a kid, and it's, you know, kind of like the same reason I got into music. My dad would take me fishing. You know? It's like, my dad's my hero, man.
Yeah.
He's just the best. And so even when I was a little kid, it's like, man, I want to be just like my dad. So that's why I'm a guitar player. But he's also a bass fisherman. So when I was a little kid, he tied me on a little frog and showed me how to bounce it around the lily pads until a big bass came and, you know, gobbled it up.
So you can do it.
Yeah. And so, you know, throughout my teenage years and stuff like that, I still fished and would just, you know, go down to the river and fish and have a couple beers and whatever. And it's always been a big kind of part of my life. But around the time I was 18 or 19, I kind of, music took off for me, and I hit the road, and here I am. I'm still on it.
Right.
But when this was the pandemic, you know.
When that happened.
Yeah, and then I went on that trip.
How many guys?
Well, it was a group of us. It was like, you know, six or eight of us.
Yeah.
Probably like three or four tents worth.
Yeah. Was it mushrooms?
LSD.
Oh, really? Old school.
Yeah. And it was such a great, you know, and that's also like I was fishing, right?
Yeah.
And then we took this acid and all of a sudden I'm like not really thinking this is a good idea anymore. Like,
which the fishing or the acid?
Just the fishing. It was like, wait, I'm like fucking with these fish, man. This isn't cool. Like,
I felt bad for the fish.
Yeah, I was just like, I'm just gonna leave them alone and just float.
Yeah,
you know, and just maybe I'll see a fish. I don't need to like
kill it.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I catch and release anyhow. You know,
you don't cook any fish.
Well, I have. Yeah, but most I'm a bass fisherman. You know, I use big old lures with, you know, hooks that they just get hooked in the lip and you can take it right out and put them right back. And, you know, I hardly ever kill a fish.
So I imagine that like the actual casting while tripping is kind of
yeah, like you're getting traces off your rod tip and your lure and your line and stuff. And it's just.
So what'd you end up doing? Just wandering around?
Well, we floated down the Buffalo River in Tennessee and got back to our campsite and had a big fire and, you know, picked a bunch of tunes and
jammed.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it was like Lindsay Lou and Joshua Rilko and my wife Allie.
Yeah. Because the acid's, it's about a 10-hour commitment, really.
Yeah, it was fun.
it's not one up and one down. It's up and down and up and down.
Right.
Yeah.
And we had this, it was just kind of mixed, it was like mixed in with this water. You were just kind of drinking it out of these water bottles.
Yeah.
So you just take a few sips and wait a little while and see how you feel. Oh, take a couple more sips.
Yeah, and then realize you took too many sips and now you got to wait it out.
Yeah, that was always perfect for me. I've never had a bad time on
hallucinogenics.
Right, on anything really. On like, you know, on psychedelics. Yeah, I've never had like a bad trip.
Yeah, that's good.
The only time I had a bad trip was on. What are they? I mean, it's called like K2 or Spice or like, you know, the shit that they used to.
I'm out of the drug loop.
So when I was in high school, you know, several of
my. Ketamine?
No. I've never done that. But when I was in high school, there was like a bunch of my friends that were on probation, right?
Yeah.
And so at that time, there was this shit that they were calling K2 or Spice. And it's basically like this incense or something. And
yeah.
I don't know what it was, but I remember. All my friends were like, yeah, it's just kind of like weed, you know, and I'm on probation, so this doesn't show up on your piss test. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then later on in my life, when I was about 18 or 19, I was on probation, and I lived in Traverse City at the time, Traverse City, Michigan.
Yeah.
And I was on probation, like I said, so I wasn't smoking weed at the time, and I was downtown. I used to busk on Front Street in Traverse City, so I'm down there playing guitar. And I met up with this fella who was just kind of like a, I don't know, it looked like he was like a street person or something. You
sure.
Know? Like he was just kind of down there doing the same thing, busking and hanging out.
Yeah.
And so we started jamming a little bit. And it's at one point he pulls out this pipe and lights it up and he goes, you want a hit? And I'm like, oh man, I'm on probation. You know, I can't smoke. He said, no, this is you know, K2 or Spice or whatever he said. And I remember all my friends, yeah, it's just like weed.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like, okay, I'll try it.
Yeah.
So I take a puff of this shit and then immediately the fear sets in and I give the pipe back to the guy and he's like, yeah, man, let's jam now or something. And I'm just like, I can't. And I put my guitar back in the case and I'm like, I'm sorry, man. Like I have to go. And he's like, what? And I just took off walking. And when I turned on Front Street, it was a hall. It was like a house of mirrors.
Yeah.
Every storefront on Front Street was exactly the same. Every person walking down the sidewalk had the exact same face.
Yeah.
I didn't know which way was left or right or how to head towards home. I was frozen in fear. And it was just, it was insane. Like I said, it was a hall of mirrors.
Yeah.
And I'm walking and every person that I see has the exact same face. And
yeah.
Is the exact same. And it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And then, when that kind of faded a little bit and I got my bearings, I was like, okay, at least I know which way to head back towards Barlow Street
from, right.
You know, so I start walking that way and then I look behind me and I see this guy in a suit with a briefcase and he's walking behind me and I go, oh shit, who's that guy? And then I look to my left and there's another guy in a suit with a briefcase. Oh fuck, they're following me, man. And it's like, you know.
How long did that last?
I mean, that must have lasted another 20 minutes or half hour. And I just all of a sudden, I was like, oh yeah, this is the court. And I'm going to, you know, my probation officer's going to know about this. They're going to send me to jail. And, you know, I was so terrified. But
yeah.
that's like the only time I've ever had a bad time on anything. And it was probably because it was so random too. Like as soon as I got
prep.
Well, it's like, I'm hanging out with this random guy in an alley.
Yeah.
And I'm on probation and stuff. And it's like, I hit it. And all of a sudden I'm like, wait, this is not good. This is I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be in this alley.
Right.
I don't know this man.
Yeah.
I don't know what I just smoked. I feel scared. Like I need to get out of here. And I'm scared of the law, you know. I'm scared of going to jail.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
A lot of things going on at once that were not conducive to a good time.
Yeah, man. That don't ever do that stuff. That's
I did something once at when I was living in San Francisco. Some guy was just I was smoking weed with this friend of mine, Liz, in an alley during the Halloween parade. And some guy just came in the alley and said, can I use your pipe for a minute? And he loaded it up. He took a hit and he said, you can have the rest of it. So I took a hit and I don't know if it was PCP or what, but like, I just like immediately just started sweating and my eyes went white and I was like, what the fuck? And I lost, like, it's surprising I didn't shit my pants.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the fuck was happening, but it only lasted for like a minute or two. I had to sit down and pull it back together, but I'd felt like I'd been shot through a fucking cannon.
Oh,
and I just had to like
walk
home and I don't even know what it was,
right.
But it didn't trip me out. It just blew my brain out for a minute.
Man, that's terrifying.
It's scary, dude.
Yeah. People shouldn't do that, man. You know, you shouldn't.
But you're staying away from like powders and pills, right?
Oh, yeah.
Bad time for that, man. You don't know what's going to kill you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I've dabbled and I got a lot of stuff out of my system early.
Yeah. Well, wait. So, Where'd you grow up?
Well, Ionia, Michigan.
Yeah. And what's that like? Is it rural?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a young kid, I grew up in Muir, which is about 7 miles outside of Ionia, which is about, you know, 20 minutes away from Grand Rapids. That's the biggest.
Grand Rapids is all right. It's not, you know, it seems like I've played there before doing comedy. It seems kind of wealthy and, you know, nice.
Yeah, there's, you know, but there's some rough areas as well, you know.
Well, I always get the sense that Michigan's kind of rough.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. But not where you grew up or how
I survived them winters, you know.
Oh, yeah.
No, where I grew up, I mean, it's like small town America.
Sure.
So it is rough. There's poverty and there's substance abuse and there's boredom, which ignites all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You have brothers and sisters?
Yeah. Yeah, I have two brothers and a sister.
Any of them in music?
No, not really. My brother, I used to jam with my brother a bunch. He plays drums and stuff, but, you know, he is a father and, you know.
Got out of the drum racket?
Yeah, he has more important things to do, you know.
He'd sit around and jam?
Well, I'm sure he'd still love to jam, but he's a dad and,
Yeah. And he's still in Michigan?
Yes, sir.
Oh. And so what was the... I know that your dad taught you how to, you know, play, but what was like, what was the family life like? Your mom still around?
Yeah, she's around.
But your biological dad was gone?
He died when I was 2 years old of a heroin overdose.
And you heard that when?
Well, when I was growing up, I always had heard that it was heart failure, you know, and I think it was just, you know, I was too young to know, but eventually, when I grew up and I heard the real story of, you know, he died with a needle in his arm and with his head in somebody's lap. You know?
Yeah. In the house?
And not in my house.
Yeah.
I think him and my mother were, I don't know if they were together at the time. He was down in somewhere near Detroit. He was a little south of, we're all kind of from Lansing area.
Yeah, yeah.
But
and then you found out the details later?
Yeah, yeah. It's once I was old enough, you know, my Aunt Roxanne and my mom and stuff. Because the older I get, the more I'm curious about him and about, you know, how he was. And I just love hearing the stories because he was a interesting fella as well, very talented and, you know, would give you the shirt off his back kind of. He was like Robin Hood of the hood. He would go into Walmart or something and put on, you know, 3 pairs of pants and 5 shirts and then walk out and steal them and then give them all to his homeless friends.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff
a
like
decent
that.
Guy.
A great decent, I mean.
But he had the drug thing.
Yeah, a lot of that, you know, I've been around a lot of that. It's just kind of, my family's kind of like a band of outlaws, you know.
Yeah. So what else do you, like, are your siblings older?
Yeah, yeah, I'm the youngest.
So did they remember your old man?
My brother, he was 5 when he died, so he remembered him a little more.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's been like, it's different for him than it is for me.
Sure.
I never remember, I don't have one memory of my biological father. And,
yeah.
And what I remember is Terry Barber.
Yeah.
My dad.
And when did your mom marry him?
Only a couple years ago, but they've been together forever.
Oh, yeah, since then?
And even since before her and my biological father, I think they were like, when they were kids, they were sort of in love. And then they, you know, went and met other people, and my mom had me and my brother with my dad and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I think Terry had always loved my mother.
Oh, wow.
And he loved my dad, too. They were good friends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were all tight.
Yeah.
And they're Northsiders, man, from Lansing, you know. They're all hanging out right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then when my dad died, I think, you know, Terry's love for my mom and us kids and stuff, he just stepped in and raised us. And that man taught me how to tie my shoes and wipe my ass.
Yeah.
He taught me about Doc Watson, and he taught me how to play guitar, how to fish, and how to, you know, it's like, it's the most beautiful thing because he's not my biological father, right?
Right.
Scientifically or whatever. But I am so his son. When I view the world, I look through a lens that is from him. He taught me how to be the man that I am.
Yeah.
You know, that's my dad.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah. And was he a professional musician?
Not really, no. I mean, he was kind of like, what would you call, like the guitar player's guitar player, or like, he was the best player around just the big scene that was happening, like on the north side.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the guy that was in the garage while everybody's standing around having some beers, and he's singing his ass off, and everybody's singing along.
Right.
And he's, you know, he was kick-ass, and he's an amazing player. He should have been a professional musician. I just don't know if the travel and everything would have been for him.
Uh-huh.
But he's so great, and he's...
Does he just play guitar?
He plays a little bit of, you know, mandolin, and he can play anything. If he picks it up, and, you know, he's musical. He's just...
Yeah, yeah.
He's just like that. And, you know, so growing up, I saw that. I was at these parties, you know, and I saw, I'm a little kid, seeing all the adults like, yeah, Terry, you know, sing that one old song. And he's, till he's purple in the face, just singing. And I'm sitting there watching. I'm going, man, everybody loves my dad. And he's like the life of the party. Like, he's so cool. Like, I want to do that, you know?
Yeah.
I want to do that when I grow up and stuff, you know?
And when did you pick up a guitar?
I mean... So we lived in this trailer park in Portland, Michigan at the time.
How many of you in the trailer?
It was me and my mom and my brother.
Okay.
And dad and I.
Yeah.
So 4 of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had this little toy guitar. It was like a, you know, it was the early 90s. So it was white, it was plastic, and it had all these neon colors all over it and buttons on the fretboard, which I assume they made... sang songs or whatever when you pressed them, but
sure.
I never had batteries in it. It had this horizontal, this like sound hole that had these plastic horizontal ridges going like the same direction that the strings would be. So my dad gave me a pick and I would scratch on that and I almost made these little percussive sounds. And that got my right hand going when I was like in my high chair, you know, 3 years old. And he'd sing songs and I'd be sitting there scratching on that little toy guitar.
Yeah.
And eventually... When I was 4 years old, we were walking through this antique store one time.
Uh-huh.
And we turned this corner, and I saw the light shining down on it. Yeah. And it was hanging on the wall there. It was this old kind of plywood guitar. The name on it was Norma.
Uh-huh.
It was just a house brand, kind of like a silver tone or Stella or something.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the painted on wood grain.
Looked
like grill marks.
Like a K guitar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw it and I just needed it. I knew with my entire soul that I needed that thing. And I was like, you know, started asking, can I have that guitar? And my dad's like, you know, come on, man. I'm broke, you know, or whatever. And I just threw myself on the floor and started throwing a fit.
Yeah.
And just kicking and screaming like some kid does that you see in the, you know, Target or something that wants a toy. I started kicking and screaming. I could not live without this guitar. And so the old lady that ran the antique store come up and she said, you know, and my dad's got, he's like, I can't do it, you know. And she said, well, what do you got on you? And my dad said, $30, you know. And she's like, I'll take it. So he took his last little $30 out of his wallet and gave it to that lady, and I got to take that guitar home.
How old are you?
I was about 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so from then, I mean, as soon as I got it home, the way I remember it, it was teach me a chord.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, because you knew he knew it all.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he showed me G, C, and D.
And that's all you need.
Yeah, absolutely. You can play a bunch of bluegrass right there, buddy, if you got a capo.
Yeah.
You're good. So I started learning, you know, lost all my money but a $2 bill. And I learned, you know, I'd play along with fiddle tunes like Salt Creek and Beaumont Rag.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 6 or 7, I could play rhythm and keep up, you know. And my dad would play the melody and I would play the rhythm.
Right.
All
those records, like, you know, what other records is your dad playing? Like, what other stuff are you learning?
I mean, at the time, it was just a lot of Doc Watson, Bill Monroe, Stanley Brothers.
Yeah.
Larry Sparks was a big one.
Yeah.
Jimmy Martin, the Osborne Brothers, you know.
So that was really your dad's music. He loved it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he's a bluegrasser, man. And but, you know, my parents also, my mom was born in 60 and he was born in 55. So they grew up, you know, they were young folks in the 70s and late 60s, you know. And so they, you know, my mom has seen The Grateful Dead and Led Zeppelin
In like Detroit?
Pontiac, like maybe the Silver Dome or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
She saw a lot of concerts and stuff. So my mom, you know, she taught me about the Beatles and Zeppelin. And my dad also, I mean, he's not just a bluegrasser. He can sing Hendrix and he can play that. He can play, you know, Sabbath and anything.
But there were records in the house?
There was a lot of records in the house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your mom was a rocker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Pearl Jam is a big one for her. So at that time, Yield, when I was a kid, I think that came out in 98. That was a big one around my house. That Pearl Jam record called Yield. Man, it's one of my favorite records of all time. It's just so good.
They're a good band.
Oh, my gosh. And yeah, so years later, you know, when I met Eddie Vedder, we did this gig and I walked around the corner and here comes Eddie Vedder and he goes, man, and he gave me this big old hug and just said some nice things. And I think it was my birthday too or something.
Yeah.
He gave me this little gift, you know, for my birthday. It was a really cool Zippo lighter.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, but I met him and I kept my shit together. And then after I met him, I walked away. And as I'm walking away, the tears were welling up in my eyes, and I went to my trailer, and I just broke down.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to cry again right now just talking about it, because he was so important, and I heard, like I said, I heard so much Pearl Jam growing up in my house, and it's also like my brother's favorite band.
Yeah.
Like, I took to Doc Watson the most.
Right.
That's my guy.
Yeah.
My brother's favorite of all time, I think, is Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I got to meet Eddie Vedder. I just know how much that would have meant to my brother and my mother and my family, our little family in that little house growing up, like in that, you know, listening to that music and how much we loved it. And I got to meet that guy and he gave me a big hug and it made me cry, you know?
Yeah. I'm getting teared up just hearing the story.
It made me cry, man. And same thing when I met Larry Sparks.
Yeah.
And he patted me on the back and said, you're doing good, son. And thank you. It was like my grandpa came back to life and patted me on the back, man. It was And I'm sitting there at the Station Inn, just standing there with tears going down my eyes. People are looking at me like I'm crazy. Like, what the hell are you crying about? Larry Sparks just patted me on the back, told me good job. Like, I'm my life is complete.
And this is what, like when you were what, like 20 or 20?
Oh,
like,
this was only last year.
Larry Sparks.
Yeah. But yeah, it was probably, yeah, it might have been 22 or something.
So how old are you now?
31.
Yeah, so you're like in your late 20s?
Yeah, yeah.
But you'd been playing for a while by that point, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been playing since I was like 4 years old, really. I mean,
no, but I mean professionally. Like you were a known guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But that don't mean anything to me.
Of course. Yeah. You know, a hero's a hero, man.
I don't see myself any differently than I did back then, you know. I just, and in fact, like, because I've had the life that I've had and I've been able to find a way to make it in music, those moments where I get to meet one of my heroes like that, they mean so much more to me because of all the work that I've put in to get here.
Yeah, sure.
It's almost like I get to a moment like that where I got to shake Eddie Vedder's hand and I think about all the sweat and blood and tears and hours of, you know, tireless nights on the tour bus that I've kind of went through to get me to that spot where I'm like, and then I think about that little kid that never thought that would ever happen.
You never did?
No. I mean, hell no.
Yeah.
I just, where I was growing up, it's like, when I was a younger kid, like fifth grade, sixth grade, I thought I was going to be like Jimi Hendrix or something. You know what I mean?
Were you playing those records? Were you playing along with them?
Yeah, absolutely. By that time, I was getting more into I was playing electric, and I was really into Hendrix and the Beatles and that whole era.
Don't you cover Sabbath?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love them. I mean, I was still young, real young. Actually, I'll never forget when I first heard Black Sabbath. And my dad would do this. He did it with David Grisman as well. He would call me from across the house, "Boomer, get in here." And I'm like, "What?" And I go in his room and he shuts the door behind me and he says, "Sit down." And it's like, oh shit, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
What did I do?
Yeah.
And then he pulls out this record. He says, "You know, this is David Grisman. You need to know this."
Yeah. Yeah.
But he sat me down one time and he did it with Johnny Winter.
Yeah.
King Crimson.
Wow.
Would specifically sit me down and say, "Now look, check this out, man. This is King Crimson." You know?
Yeah. Like, do you remember which record?
I mean, I think it was the one with the big face on it.
Yeah,
21st century
schizoid
man.
Yeah.
But, and then, I mean, also like in the court of the Crimson King and all that, you know. But I remember Black Sabbath, he sat me down, and I must have been 7 years old. And by this time, I was into Lon Chaney Jr. and Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and the old monster films.
Yeah.
The Wolfman I was infatuated with.
Yeah.
So maybe he figured I was big enough to hear Black Sabbath.
Right.
But it scared the living shit out of me. He turned the speakers way up and he dropped that needle on the first song, Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
From Black Sabbath.
The first record. Yeah.
What is this that stands before me?
Yeah.
You know, figure in black, which points at me. And I heard all that, and I could see the devil, and I could hear the sound of the bells and the storms. And I was like, like, let me the hell out of here, you know? It scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, yeah. So you didn't get through the whole album that first time.
I think I made it to the faster riff, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I was just like, at that point, I was like, this is too much, man.
Yeah.
Oh, God, please help me. You know, Ozzy's screaming. Oh, fuck, it's so scary.
Yeah.
You know,
but it landed.
It stuck with me for sure. And my dad, he had a lot of like DVDs and I mean, before it was DVDs, it was VHS tapes, and he'd record over anything. He'd record Austin City Limits or stuff on, you know, I don't know where them tapes ended up. You know, there's just, they got lost in the
I mean, no one has anything to play them on anymore.
Yeah.
There's probably a box of them somewhere.
But there was, like, footage of me playing in my high chair back then and stuff, too.
With
like,
a little toy guitar?
Yeah. I remember there being camcorder footage of that somewhere. That's just, it's lost. And probably,
is it? You don't think it's in the attic?
There is no attic. I mean, there's been several different houses from then. And
boxes moving around, things get thrown out.
Yeah, and just lost and left behind in the... You know, and moving and stuff.
Well, when did you start figuring out your way around, you know, these runs, these leads?
Well, it's kind of funny. Like I said, I was a rhythm player first.
Right. Well, that's how everybody has to start, I'd imagine.
Yeah. And I played you know, rhythm while my dad played the leads. And like I said, we'd play tunes like Beaumont Rag and stuff, and I would play without a capo down here out of the open A position and D.
Yeah.
And then my dad would put the capo on the second fret and play in D but out of a C position.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So that I also, you know, learned how to open two guitars up like that.
Right.
You know, have somebody play down low and have somebody capo up and play, and all of a sudden it sounds bigger.
Right.
But I think I played rhythm first, and later on when I got an electric guitar, for Christmas I got this little red mini Stratocaster and a pig nose amp.
Yeah. Oh, a little pig nose.
Yeah, little battery powered amp.
Yeah.
And it was a mini Squire Strat. And that's when I started learning Voodoo Child, Hey Joe, you know, and Paranoid. And,
how old were you?
10 or 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're just listening to the records and picking it up?
Yeah. I mean, I just had listened to it so much, and I kind of was already a guitar player at that point.
Yeah.
So I just kind of was mimicking the sounds. And yeah, I mean, I know when I hear Voodoo Child, it's like, okay, he's in an E position and he's doing the little hammer-on thing with the wah pedal. And it's like, I just kind of started picking it up. And I mean, that's how I've learned everything my whole life. Until now, I've actually started, I mean, in the last year, I've actually started like really studying and practicing and having like a deliberate practice. But up until then, it's kind of like the telephone game. You know, and that's, people would be like, oh, that's not the right word, or that's not the right. Sure. It's like, well, shit, man. My dad learned this off a record or from somebody at a festival or something.
Right.
And then he sang it his way, and then I learned it from him. And so, you know, sorry if one word got changed throughout all that, but this is the way that I sing it, you know. And
it's all about making it your own anyways, isn't it?
Well, to me, it's about playing it true to where I learned it and just to where my heart is.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just who I am, and I'm, you know, it's like I learned from my dad, and I like to try to play it like he would, you know, if I can. I try to honor him and his style because he is a unique player, and he's the man. So to me, it's like he never was a professional musician, but I am.
Right.
So I get to almost, you know, do what he could have done with his sound.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like what stylistically, though, I like bluegrass enough. You know, and I always have sort of gravitated to it. But it's not where I come from. You know, like I've over the years, I still buy a lot of records.
Mm-hmm.
I got those Earl Scruggs records. I got the Bill Monroe records. I got, you know, those albums that Earl Scruggs made with his kids.
Yeah,
the Earl Scruggs Experience records or whatever it is.
Yeah, they were getting kind of experimental.
Yeah, with the old man. That was kind of.
Those
are amazing records.
Well, they were cutting like Bob Dylan tunes and stuff, right?
Right, but I like that they got the old man to get hip, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's badass.
Yeah. Are those guys still around? Any of them? Well, Scruggs's?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Randy's...
You don't know Randy?
I don't know Randy.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, Earl was very hip, man. He was... Yeah.
It's great. But like, it seems to me, like when I first saw you and why I became sort of like, what is going on, is that it's... You know, that music sort of has a place, you know, in the world. You know, that's specific, right? And then when I saw you play it, I'm like, he's broadening it somehow. Like, he's making it more accessible. I don't know if it's just you or your skill set, but it seemed to me that you were, like, kind of infusing new life into it. And it's always impressive to hear real bluegrass go because it's so fast. But do you feel... You know, as a guy who honors this legacy, that you're making the audience bigger, or that you're bringing something different to it.
I'm just
you don't know. You're just playing.
Yeah, I really don't know, man. I'm just doing what I'm trying to do, and yes, I know what you're saying. There's maybe some younger folks that come to my shows,
or
you know, older folks too. That's the thing
about bluegrass, right? And even about the choices of covers you're making, I would say that some older folks, like your dad's age or older, grew up with that shit too.
Well, yeah, I'm just playing the music that I, you know, grew up on and that I love. And that's, you know, I'll play some Bill Monroe song or something, and then later on in the set, I'll play something by Johnny Winter or something.
Yeah. What do you play by Johnny?
Let's see. Cheap Tequila.
Yeah.
Ain't Nothing to Me.
Yeah.
You know? And my dad played those songs. You know, those are songs that were in my kitchen when I was a kid, and they mean so much to me because they can take me back there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like deja vu or something, but I can choose to do it.
When did you start picking up those fucking bluegrass runs?
Oh, yeah. So what I was saying is I got the electric guitar, right? And I started playing a little Hendrix and shit. And that's what got me soloing.
Right.
And I started playing. But when I first started soloing, I wasn't playing bluegrass licks. I was playing, you know, blues. Like, you know, I was playing Hendrix kind of stuff. Classic rock guitar, you know. Yeah.
Pentatonics.
Yeah, exactly. And so I joined some bands, and the Sabbath and stuff eventually led to like heavy metal, because I really just wanted to play music with people that were my age. The folks that I was playing with was the bingo crowd, you know. I'd go down to the Maple River Strummers and jam down there with old Gladys on her hammer dulcimer and shit.
Yeah.
And eventually I got like, man, I just want to play with some folks that are my age, that like maybe after we jam we could like go skateboarding or play video games or something. You know.
So your dad's bringing you to the bingo crowd?
Well, I mean, yeah, when I was...
Yeah, no, it's
just
great.
That's just the bluegrass crowd. I mean, it was like, I was always playing with folks that were like 60 years old or older.
Yeah.
You know, and aside from a select few, you know.
Right.
But no, it was almost when by the time I got to the middle school, I wasn't going around telling everybody I played bluegrass. It was like, not that it was embarrassing,
right,
but it wasn't...
Right, wasn't cool.
No, it was like, oh, I play like old people music with a bunch of old people. Cool. Yeah. I wasn't bragging about that.
Yeah.
You know? And I got to the point where it's just, man, I really want to play with people that are my age. So I ended up in heavy metal, and because that's the only thing that was going on.
Were you doing originals or all covers?
Yeah, it was all originals then.
Oh, yeah. What was the name of that band?
To Once Darkened Skies.
To Once Darkened Skies.
Yep. And then I went to another band called A Day of Moments, and that was a little less heavy. But then at that time, I had been in a couple bands, and they all broke up.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, my life at the time was kind of, it was really tough. Like
well, how old were you? 15?
Yeah, exactly.
Tough how?
Tough that my parents were lost in their kind of addiction for a while.
Oh, really?
I had moved out of the house, you know, by the time.
What drug?
Meth.
Oh.
And it was... You know, it was a rough time for a lot of people around that area and stuff, you know. And they've since, you know, gotten clean, and they're doing great today, and I'm really proud of them, you know. But yeah, we all struggled back then. And
did you get on the meth?
I mean, I certainly did it a few times.
Yeah.
I never got, like, hooked on anything.
Because
I grew up around a lot of addicts, and I, you know.
Can go either way. You were able to see what it did?
Oh, yeah. I said I didn't want to go there.
Yeah.
But... Anyways, just to finish on the how did I get around to the bluegrass licks was when my band, A Day of Moments, broke up, it was kind of because of substance abuse. I think one of our guitar players struggled and he kind of relapsed, and you know, it kind of broke the band up. And so at that point, I had started, it was at the time I was really getting back into Doc Watson on YouTube and stuff. And, you know, I never had a computer at my house growing up, so I would be over at my friend's house seeing all this footage of Doc Watson for the first time, surfing YouTube for hours, just watching Doc. And I didn't even own an acoustic guitar. My friend Zach Lauer, he had this little shitty, like, Esteban guitar or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was a... You know, but I pretty much like stole it from him.
Yeah,
because all I want to do is play this Doc Watson stuff.
So you're watching him, so you can see how his fingers work too, right?
Yeah, but I couldn't do it, and I went back over to my parents' house one time to jam with my dad.
Yeah,
and I go over there, and I said, "Dad, let's play Salt Creek. I want to try to solo over it. I don't understand how to do it." And he goes, "Okay." So we play Salt Creek. And he takes a solo, and then he plays, and I'm like, okay, that sounds badass. And then I go to play it, and I just start playing all this blues, like pentatonic stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what the hell?
Yeah.
It's not the same. And I started realizing that you have to play the melody. It's not you just, there's three chords, and then, okay, you're on G, solo for a second over G, and then it changes to C, then you solo in C, then it goes to D, and you solo in C. No, that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
What's happening is there's a direct melody that you have to play. There is no solo.
Right.
You can embellish it a little bit. But
right.
No, you have to play. Dun da da dun dun da 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 da. That's the solo.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And also with bluegrass, the guitar just keeps going. I mean, there's a rhythm guitar, but the fingers on the other guitar, they just keep moving through the whole song a lot of times, right?
Yeah. Yeah, man.
And it's like, but it's also like the banjo. It never stops. Like there's like the rhythm guitar is the only thing that's going to be like, but everything else is very fluid.
Yeah.
And so from that run, you figured it out.
Well, it was the start. You know, I learned how to do Salt Creek, and then I took my guitar back and I knew what to do with the approach was, okay, it's not just soloing over chords. It's right. I have to learn note for note what is Doc Watson playing.
Right.
So I learned a tune called Nothing to It. Yeah. And that really helped. And from there, I just all of a sudden it was my electric guitar that was collecting dust.
Yeah.
And then eventually I wanted to get myself a new guitar. And that's how I stumbled on my dad's guitar, which had been sold 6 or 7 years previously.
In the dark time?
Yeah.
He sold it?
He did, yeah, we didn't have hot water or electricity or food in the cupboards or nothing.
And yeah.
That's the only thing we had that was kind of worth anything. So he walked out one day and he was going to sell it. And you got to understand, this Martin guitar was our family jewel.
Right.
And his dad bought it for him when I was little. And when I was a little kid, that was the guitar that I sat on the other side of. I learned all these tunes.
Yeah.
And he said, son, this will be your guitar one day. You know, and I kind of built a dream upon that. And then one day he sold it and I was crushed.
But you knew the number? Like, how'd you find it?
Well, because it's a distinctive model. It's a 160th anniversary commemorative, like limited edition Martin guitar. It's called D93.
From what year?
1993.
Okay.
And so there's only so many of them. And what happened was, like I said, I was playing on that Esteban guitar, whatever it was. It might have been an Ibanez. Yeah. I don't know. But I was playing on that, and it was just a piece of junk. So I start looking. I'm like, man, I need to get me a real guitar. And it's not like I could afford one anyways, especially a Martin.
Yeah.
You know. But I was looking anyways, just dreaming, yeah, like I always did.
Sure.
I always dreamed and looked at these magazines and stuff. Oh, I'll never be able to afford this shit book. Man, wouldn't it be cool?
Yeah.
And so I'm scrolling, and I ended up on this unofficial Martin Guitar Forum website. And I'm scrolling for used guitars, hoping to find one for $200 or something.
A Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, boom, there goes a Martin D93. And I go, whoa, that's just like my dad's. And I click on it. And then I'm like, holy shit, because there's this wear down by the pick guard that was his pinky.
Yeah.
And it's got a crack on the fifth fret and the binding around the fretboard. And I know those marks. And I look at the pictures of this guitar, and I'm going, holy shit, this is my dad's guitar. And it was some guy up in Massachusetts. His name's Joe Singleton, actually.
Yeah.
He owned it at the time. He had bought it from Elderly Instruments. He actually got it from his friend who bought it from Elderly Instruments.
Yeah.
But at any rate, this guy owned my dad's guitar that had been kind of gone from our family for the last few years.
And at this point, you're not making records yet, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, I don't even have a job. I'm a teenager.
Okay.
I'm, you know, sell a little weed.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Shrooms and shit.
Yeah. So what do you do?
I sent this guy a book, you know, of an email. I mean, I typed and typed, and I was crying, and the tears were falling on the keyboard, and I was typing, and I mean, this is my dad's guitar. I never thought I'd see it again.
Yeah.
And I just told this guy, man, please don't sell it. Like, I'll do anything, you know? And you can actually find this thread on, like, it's called, like, this Yulu site or something, like, unofficial Martin Guitar Forum website. It's actually still up there.
So you wrote it on the forum?
I did. I said, man, this is my dad's guitar. It was supposed to be mine one day. Please don't sell it to anybody but me. You don't understand. This guitar is supposed to be mine. And so he sent me a message and said, you know, well, yeah, if you want to buy it, it's yours. But I got two other people right now on eBay with cash. And, you know, and he's kind of like, well, how do I know you're not some 17-year-old kid, like, talking out of your ass? And I'm just, you know, I didn't seem like he really was
buying it
at first.
Yeah.
And then Marla stepped in. His wife.
Oh.
She saw the thread. She heard the story. She said, this is Marla. I'm Joe's wife. Don't worry. I ain't going to let him sell it. And I said, Joe, can you take payment? Can you take a payment plan? Can I give you, you know? And he said, no, man, like I, you know, like I said, I got people with cash right now. I kind of need the money. Marla, yeah, we'll take your payments. So I mowed grass, flipped weed, took back pop cans, everything I could do for 3 months. I made it my goal to work my ass off so that I could make $700 in a month for 3 months and send him $700 for 3 months, $2,100 total, to send me my dad's guitar back to me. And I did it. I mean, I started with an eighth, and I sold that, and I worked my way up to a quarter, and then eventually I had an ounce, and it was like, I did that, you know? And like I said, I literally, we'd have a party or something, and I need all the beer cans, you know, from tonight, because, you know, I was in my top dresser drawer, I had this little pile of money, and I had to make $700 every month. And I did that for 3 months. I sent him $700. He sent my dad's guitar back to me, and it showed up in the mail one day, and I got it out of the box, threw it in my friend Benji's truck. We drove over to my dad's house and walked in with it, set it on the kitchen table. He goes, "What the fuck is that?" He thought it was a prank.
Right.
You know, and I go, "Open it up." And, you know, he's like, "What the hell?" So he sits down and slowly undoes each kind of buckle on the case. Yeah. And he opens it up about an inch, and he just sees it, and then he just puts his head down on the guitar case and starts crying. Eventually pulls it out, strums a chord on it. By that time, me and my brother and my mom are standing there. We're all crying.
Yeah.
That the guitar's back in at home.
Yeah.
And he played John Deere Tractor on it, you know, by Larry Sparks, that, you know, and
you guys recorded that on that last record,
We
right?
did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first song he played when he pulled that guitar out. And he told me that he felt like his mom was in the room with him, and she's been dead, you know. But yeah, he said it was like his mom came back to life or something. That's, you know. But now he has the guitar still to this day, and he plays it, and he sounds great, and it's back in his hands, and it's just so fucking beautiful, and man.
What a great story.
I just love them.
And what, have you been in touch with the Singletons?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've, a couple years later after I bought the guitar, like, because they go up to Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival up there in New York. And I met Joe one night.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was back maybe before I stopped drinking, and I probably had a few in me.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him about that guitar, and man, we both were sitting there crying.
That's crazy. And you met Marla,
too? I did, yeah. And they're wonderful people. We've become friends.
It's an important part of the Billy Strings mythology.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, thank you so much, Joe and Marla, for believing in that little kid and getting that guitar back to where it belongs. Because you want to know what? It was sentimental to Joe as well, because he bought it from his, or actually, I think it might have been gifted to him.
Yeah.
But my dad sold the guitar to Elderly Instruments.
Where's that?
In Lansing, Michigan. It's a great store.
Yeah.
Yeah. Specializing in like acoustic instruments and stuff. He sold it to Elderly, which is where he got it from originally. From his dad bought it for him.
Yeah.
So it's sentimental there. And then it was sentimental to me. And then when the guitar got sold to Elderly, somebody bought it who was Joe Singleton's best friend, and this guy had a stroke, leaving him unable to play, and people thought that he would maybe get better, and then he died. So this guitar was Joe's best friend's guitar, and then, you know, it came back to me, which was kind of full circle. But yeah, the guitar's been on a journey, and it's a hell of an axe, man. It's a great, great sounding guitar. Yeah,
it's kind of interesting. These instruments hold so much history, and they're so different from each other. What are you playing now?
I mean, on stage, I play a Preston Thompson guitar.
What's in that case?
That's a 1940 D28 Martin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when do you start, like after you get the guitar back for your dad, I mean, when do you start playing professionally in a real way?
Well, once we got that guitar back, then it was like jam time.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking for a guitar for myself when I found my dad's.
Yeah.
And then when I found it, I was like, I got to do whatever I can do to get that back. So then once I got that one back, then it was like, okay, now I can continue to find my own. And what I ended up with was a Martin D1. It was about a $900 guitar, made a Sapele back and sides. It was like a low-end Martin that's actually still real wood.
Yeah. As opposed to,
you know, just a more expensive, better model. And the folks who I was living with at the time, it was kind of like, almost like my foster parents, if you will.
Who took you in? Who were they?
Well, I started crashing with my friend Benji Haney.
Yeah.
Who is one of my best friends.
Yeah.
He is one of my best friends to this day. But at the time, like, yeah, he's my skateboarding buddy, and home life was rough. So I left there when I was like 13, you know, and I kind of couch surfed for a while, joined metal bands and stuff. Eventually, one summer I was staying with my friend Benji for about a week. I stayed there for about a week straight, and finally his mom goes, you know, hey man, don't you have your own house to go back to?
Yeah.
And I just, with a big knot in my throat, you know, I'm sorry, Mrs. Haney, like, I'll take off, holding back tears, and I grabbed my backpack and my skateboard and I left, you know. She's kind of like, geez, you've been sleeping on my couch for a fucking week, kid.
Yeah.
You know, and then so when I left, Benji kind of chewed his mom out and was like, man, you don't know what he's going through. Like, he's, you know, not, he doesn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
You know, and she didn't know that. So she called me back and said, please come back. I didn't know. You can stay here. You know, and so they took me in kind of like as one of their own and set me up a little room in the basement and was like, man, you can stay here, but you got to go back to school, you know, and you're going to be in at 8 o'clock with the other kids to eat dinner with us like a family.
Yeah.
And I, maybe for years, have not had that kind of stability or, you know, sat down around a dinner table with the family, like, or even had dinner, you know, cooked. Like, it was like, you know, it was just so strange to me, just the regular things that families do. Like, you know, I would, after my grandma died, I mean, we never had Christmas together or anything like that. It all fell apart.
Chaos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, they took me in as one of their family, you know, and now it's still that way. I mean, that's, and it was that's what set me on the path that I'm on too, is because I was going down the path of, okay, well, I'm never going to amount to anything. All my friends and family and stuff are like either drug addicts or going to prison or, you know, just, it's just a hard to break out of cycle.
What were you on probation for?
I mean, at that time, I was on probation a couple of different times, but for that time, probably MIPs, just minor in possession, getting caught while drunk and being 14 or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, they took me in and put a roof over my head. They got me a mattress downstairs. And like I said, she said, man, you can stay here, but you got to go back to school. So I started going back to school. But this time I wasn't the class clown. I wanted to get it over with.
Yeah.
Because I hated this shit.
Yeah.
I fucking hate school, you know? So instead of being the class clown this time, I was the one telling the class clown, dude, just shut the fuck up. Let's just do our work. Stop giving the teacher a hard time so we can get this over with and get done. You know?
Yeah. And we all want out.
Yeah. None of us want to be here.
Yeah.
So just fucking shut up, you know? And so I eventually graduated a year late, but I graduated.
Yeah.
And I got a little diploma and it gave me a sense of accomplishment. And so after that, I was like, I'm free. I'm done with school. I need to get the hell out of Ionia, you know?
Because
Ionia to me was like black and white.
It was,
you know, and I moved up to Traverse City and all of a sudden it was Technicolor. It was like beaches and there was like an artsy community. There was like coffee houses and breweries and people doing paintings and, you know, cooking good food. And there was like cute girls and, you know, it was like, it was just like, holy shit, this is way better.
Yeah.
So I moved up there, and at that time I was able to kind of try to choose my friends wisely in order to not get wrapped up into the same scene.
Yeah.
Now, eventually I did find the drug scene in Traverse City, but I, you know, it was like I was trying to stay away from it, you know.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, moving to Traverse City, I met some folks that also sent me on the path that I'm on now, because at that time, bluegrass to me was very much Bill Monroe, you know, Kenny Baker fiddle, like I said, Flat and Scruggs, the Stanley Brothers.
Yeah.
I had no idea that there was even like a progressive side of bluegrass. I mean, the most progressive stuff that we had in my collection was the Bluegrass Album Band, J.D. Crow, you know.
Yeah.
But like, and maybe the Osborne Brothers would be considered pretty progressive for that time, you know?
Yeah.
But I had no idea that there were bands like Leftover Salmon, Yonder Mountain String Band, the infamous String Dusters, Green Sky Bluegrass ended up being a huge influence on me. And they're my brothers, man. They, you know, and they also opened me up to like Grateful Dead music, which at the time I kind of like could not palate.
Yeah.
I couldn't read it. I didn't understand. It was like listening to bebop or something. It just went over my head. It sounded like five people playing five different songs for 40 minutes, and I just didn't understand why.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But when I got into Green Sky Bluegrass...
Well, Jerry was a bluegrass player.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I came into like listening to the Grateful Dead through like the back door. Like a lot of people get into bluegrass through the Dead.
Right.
I got into the Dead through bluegrass. I was a bluegrass player. My dad, when I was 7 years old, taught me about David Grisman.
Yeah, who played with Jerry a lot.
And, well, to me at the time, who played with Doc Watson.
Right, okay, so right.
It was like, he made a record with Doc.
Yeah.
Doc and Dog. That's the record that my dad showed me when I was young. So it's like, okay, who's this Jerry guy? He's playing with David Grisman. He must be good.
Right.
So then I, you know, checked out his band, and as a teenager, I didn't understand. My mom, when I was 12 years old, she gave me this grinder with it had the steel your face on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I never knew what that was. I just knew it was a cool grinder.
Yeah.
And I still have it, you know.
Yeah.
And it was like, I knew I was supposed to like this band.
Right.
And I knew that they were a big part of like, you know, I listened to everything else. I listened to the Beatles. I listened to a bunch of music from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Edgar Winter and, you know, like just a bunch of different stuff. But the Dead never, besides Casey Jones.
Right.
That was the one song that, you know.
Yeah, of course. It was on the radio. Yeah. The one song that's on the radio.
Yeah, it's like the one song that's actually a song.
And it's Cocaine, so it's all good.
Yeah, so that was the one song that I liked. But otherwise, you know, I would hear it and I just go, I just don't know. But later on in life when I met up with Green Sky Bluegrass and stuff and I started jamming with them, it was the same exact thing again that I went through in middle school. It's like, whoa, these people are closer to my age. Look at the crowd. There's a bunch of young folks out there. It's like... I learned about String Cheese Incident. One of my friends, Kelsey Paxai, she's a sweetheart. She showed me String Cheese Incident, or she was just jamming it at a party or something.
Yeah,
YouTube, and I saw a video of Bill Nershey on stage at Red Rocks.
Yeah,
and he's playing flat picking guitar, and then you look at the crowd and there's 10,000 people in it, and I'm just going, what in the fuck is this? Because no bluegrass concert has 10,000 people ever, you know. And especially with like tie-dyed. You know,
yeah.
Like I said, it was like
the hippie look.
Yeah, and like spinning around in circles and dancing and having a good time, and like younger people. Like I said, it's like, whoa, there's people that are actually around my age that are into this. I want to do that.
Yeah.
And then I started really. Green Sky Bluegrass was the first band that I really took a liking to, and they're also from Michigan. And so I met those guys and I started jamming with them a little bit, and they invited me to come sit in with them. And we did this like really long jam or something. And I was just like, whoa, that was cool. It was a conversation. And it started opening up my perception into allowing these long improvised jams. And I started to understand what it means. It's not just endless noodling. It's not, you know, which is what it sounded like to me coming from such a structured bluegrass kind of background.
Right.
It's like, no, this is a conversation. We're just allowing the music to take us wherever it wants to go.
Yeah.
And we're kind of tapping into a channel here and we're going. And so I went from just not understanding it to just being obsessed with jamming,
and
improvising like that. And I got really into the Dead for a while. And also
you're working your hand, right?
Absolutely. But it's a musical conversation. It turns into you're on stage and you know your part. And you, when your part comes, you've played it, you've practiced it. It's all ready to go. It's pre-prepared.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a TV dinner.
Yeah.
This is like, we're cooking.
Yeah, yeah.
We're adding spices in real time. We're, you know, it's...
riffing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
And you played with Bob, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've played with those guys. And, and I did a thing with Bill Kreutzmann, which was amazing. And, you know, got to play with the late, great James Casey on that. And jam with Carlos Santana a little bit on that. It's beautiful. It's an absolutely... You know, beautiful community.
How'd your first record come about?
My first album?
Yeah.
I just was writing songs. You know, I was in a duo with this guy named Don Julin.
He's a mandolin player?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I moved to Traverse City, I, like I said, I was kind of playing around up there a little bit. doing some open mic nights and stuff like that. And I played with this band called M23 Strings for a while with my buddy Paul Kirchner and Kurt Westy and Marlene Wood. And we were jamming. And I think Don came out to see me one night. Again, this guy plays with David Grisman.
Yeah. Grisman's the center of the wheel here.
Yeah. So I've seen Don Julin on the internet playing with David Grisman. And I'm going, wow, you know.
Yeah.
So he kind of gives me his card and says, man, we ought to jam sometime. And we got together and started jamming. And it was an interesting thing because he comes very much from a jazz background.
Yeah.
And was just kind of coming around to actually enjoying Bill Monroe.
Right.
And I'm like, that's all I know.
Yeah.
So it was like.
So you brought him with you. You brought him around.
Yeah. But he brought me around to showing me how you can actually make a living playing music. And that, you remember when I said earlier that when I was in middle school, I thought I was going to be some like Jimi Hendrix guy or something? Like,
yeah.
Well, you know, I quickly realized that that's not a reality. But later on in life, you know, when I was like 18 or so, I met Don, and what he showed me is like, yeah, you might not be a guitar god, but you could make a living, and you don't have to, you know, continue scrubbing the shit out of toilets and cleaning up puke at the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to do that. Like, and so he kind of showed me the ropes, like, you know, booked us gigs, and we played a bunch of gigs, and it was basically as much as we could work, we did.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did that for a couple years, and we just worked our asses off.
You made the Fiddle Tune X album?
Yep, and one called Rock of Ages as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, we played a lot of gigs, and our buddy Kevin Gills jumped in on bass for a little bit, you know. And Kevin's just the best guy ever.
Yeah.
But yeah, Don, he showed me how to basically make a living at this shit, you know.
And then the rest is history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you put your band together?
Well, yeah, you know, we were probably working too hard, and I don't know, we were just around each other a lot, and we kind of started to, me and Don, you know, it seems like we sort of grew apart.
Yeah.
Which happens.
Yeah.
You know, and I think when that kind of came to a head, I decided that I was going to move away from Michigan, because I had lived in Michigan my whole life.
Yeah.
And I had never even really been anywhere else besides, you know, going on tour or whatever a few times. But I was like, it's either Nashville or Denver, because Denver's got weed. I love weed. And Nashville has pickers. I love pickers. Because the thing about living in Traverse City was there's like a lot of great songwriters there. There's a lot of great, you know, musicians that are, you know, finger picking in A minor and singing about the good old days or whatever, but I was very interested in playing hardcore bluegrass.
Yeah.
I wanted pickers. So, you know, Nashville was the move.
Yeah.
And I had just started dating this girl at the time. Her name's Allie. And liked her a lot, you know, and then the band was going to break up, and I made this decision that I was going to move to Nashville. And I kind of had lunch with her one morning and said, you know, sorry, babe, like, I'm leaving, I'm going to Nashville. And kind of like, it's been real. And she's like, dude, I'll come with you. I'm like, are you serious? And so then I had this partner to, like, go do it with, you know. And she moved to Nashville with me and has been, you know, there by me the whole step of the way and through all my bullshit and, you know, mistakes I've made and things like that. You know, we've come out stronger than ever and got married last September.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't know if I could have made it through a lot of this stuff without her, you know?
Yeah. What made you stop drinking?
A really bad hangover.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
So bad that I haven't drank in 7 years bad.
Yeah. And what was the booze?
Wine and liquor and beer and, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just, we had this gig. It was at, like, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We had a giant crowd. We sold a bunch of merch. It was like one of our first big gigs. And I just was going hard, man. Like, during the show, I was drinking PBR. And then afterwards, somebody offered me some wine, and I had some of that. And then we went to the bar. We had a bunch of old fashions. And the next morning, you know, we had to drive to South Carolina to make this gig at RJ Rocker's Brewing Company. It was about a 5-hour haul.
Yeah.
We had to be there at 3 p.m.
Yeah.
To sound check and shit. And the next morning I wake up and I go to get in the van. I'm like, oh shit. And I go over to the bushes and I throw up. And I go, okay, we're good. Let's go. Hit the highway. 10 minutes later, I got to throw up again. Okay, fuck. Pull over. Throw up. Okay, we keep going. 10 minutes later. And this went on, you know, I had to stop every 10 minutes. It got to the point where I was like, we just have to keep going because we're so late. I was just puking out the window as it's going down the road, you know. And we were extremely late for the gig.
Yeah.
We had to set up our gear in front of the audience.
Yeah.
It was embarrassing. I felt so unprofessional. And this was at a time where my career was just starting to, like, become something that I could see actually being feasible up ahead. Yeah. And after that, I just, you know, was like, okay, like, do you want a career or do you want to fucking get hammered? Because it's going to be one or the other for you, bud, because I just don't know when to stop sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not that I drank all the time or, you know, it wasn't like a every day or every even every weekend.
But when you did.
Well, it's like sometimes when it's going down good and it's a celebration thing, I don't know when to stop.
You know?
It's like there's never like, okay, I'm good. Like, I think I'm drunk enough.
Yeah.
It's like that never happens. It's just, let's take it. We have to finish the bottle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like a binger or something.
Right.
So yeah, that was the last time. That was June 16th, 2016 was that gig, and I haven't had a sip since, and I'm sure glad about it because I've been able to focus on my guitar playing and singing and writing and performing and, you know, doing all this shit. And also, like, I haven't made an ass of myself too much.
Right.
I could make an ass of myself pretty easily, but if I was drinking, I don't even know if I'd still be here. I'd probably be canceled or some shit.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, for sure. And also, it's you're professional.
I want to be.
No, you are. I mean, it's like, I saw you at the Hollywood Bowl for Willie's birthday. You know, and you're up there with, you know, those are big shots, man. You know, Don was putting everything together, and, you know, you're up there with Willie and Keith and everybody.
Hell yeah,
and
man.
It's, yeah, I mean, I know you love to play and everything, but you know how to show up 100% for work.
Oh, that's my duty, yeah.
Right. And if booze is going to fuck that, fuck it.
Oh, exactly. Let's get rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I care. I'm much more invested in my playing than I am my party life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's good because a lot of guys don't end up with those priorities.
Well, I really don't. You know, like I said, I got a lot of it out of my system.
Yep.
And
you've written about it.
I really don't care about the party anymore. In fact, like, I kind of hate being around, like, a lot of people and, like, when it's loud. Like, I can't even go into restaurants, man.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know if it's my ears. Like, I have, like, tinnitus, you know?
Yeah, sure.
In fact, like, recently my ears have been ringing like hell.
Yeah.
Crazy. But, yeah, sometimes I can't even go into a restaurant if there's a lot of people talking and shit. Like, the last thing that sounds good to me is being in, like, a party with, like, a bunch of people talking over each other.
Yeah.
It's like, my idea of a good time is, like, going back into my hotel and watching Better Call Saul.
Yeah, good. Yeah. And Renewal, was that sort of the, you know, was that coming out of all that stuff?
It's supposed to be, yeah. You know, I've been through, I've been, like, doing lots of therapy. Like, around the time I was about 24 or 25, a lot of my childhood stuff just caught up with me and hit me in the face. And,
yeah.
And I realized how severe some of it was, and there's things that I've never talked about that I don't know if I ever will, that were more severe than I think anybody will ever imagine.
Yeah.
You know, even myself.
Yeah. But you processed it with a therapist.
I processed it all, and I've been processing it all, and I'm becoming slowly but surely over the last, you know, like I said, 6-7 years, a more psychologically integrated person.
Oh, good. That's good. And then I guess, like, the album with your dad was sort of a full circle thing.
Oh, man. That was something that was on my bucket list for a long time and something that I was afraid that, you know what I mean? Like, I'm out on tour, and the gigs just come. They get piled up, and next thing you know, it's like I'm out for years, and it's like, oh shit, when am I going to make this record with my dad? So I just called my manager one day and said, yo, let's just block off the time, let's do this, and we did it. It was so awesome. Yeah, and it got nominated for a Grammy. I got to take my dad out to the Grammys and, like, let him walk on the red carpet and shit, and, like, it was so awesome.
Did he love it?
He did, yeah, and my mom too, you know. Like, growing up, my mom would watch that stuff on TV, like Entertainment Tonight or whatever. She's like, she's into fashion. She's into, you know, all that. And it was just cool to take them to see all the crazy outfits. And
everything.
But my dad is like, he's such a, like, country bumpkin kind of. Yeah. We're on the red carpet, and like this guy from Billboard is like, "Oh my God, you guys look fabulous. Who are you wearing?" And all this.
Yeah.
And my dad's like, "Well, these are Levi's, and you know, I got this shirt from the Western store, and then my son bought me this jacket."
It's like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, man. And now you're working with John Bryan, and that must be a whole new world.
Yeah,
in a way.
He's a genius. I'm very excited about what we got going. And so an interesting thing, I guess, about this record is that we started out here in L.A.
Yeah.
We're working in Frank Sinatra's room there, east-west. And so we started out here. We did a few tunes. And at this time, I was kind of building this studio back in Nashville.
Yeah.
Because I've really been wanting to just build a studio and kind of have a place where I can just go throw paint at the wall kind of 9 to 5 whenever I'm like on my days off.
Yeah.
So I've been building that. And so I kind of came to this assumption where it's like, what if we make the basic tracks in Nashville, record them at my house, and then we come out to, you know, I send them to John and see what he would do differently or whatever. So we kind of recorded most of the record at my house.
Yeah.
And
did he come out there?
No, it was just the band and my engineer, Brandon Bell.
Yeah.
And so we recorded a bunch of stuff, and then, you know, I just came out here last week to kind of put ornaments on it. It's like we build the Christmas tree in Nashville, then we come out to L.A. to put ornaments on it.
Yeah.
And that's where I really get to see John Bryan shine. But, you know, if it would have been his way, we would have recorded it all out there because the fidelity is just so much better, and he's really into...
Nashville?
In L.A.
Oh, okay.
With the room mics and everything, you know.
Yeah.
He's just so, him and Greg are so geniuses when it comes to fidelity and how to record things. And I've learned so much just in this last week working with him. Like, you know, I record by myself at home and I'm doing things. I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I know I want the vocal to sound all weird, like it's coming through a telephone or something.
Yeah.
So I take the EQ and I jack it all up. And then I get out there and John's like, "Oh, well, that's one way to do it." You know?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, like one of the things I learned is that the trick to recording something lo-fi is not to take something good and then EQ it all jacked up like I did.
Yeah.
It's to take something and, you know, to have a really good mic on a really small speaker or something to play a lo-fi sound but get a really great recording of it.
Right, yeah,
you know?
Right, yeah.
So it's just little stuff like that, you know.
So are you re-recording stuff?
Well, we're just, you know, fixing some stuff and, maybe re-recording a little bit, but we're done, you know. It's like...
Oh, great.
It's off to mixing now.
What's it called?
Well, I believe it's going to be called Highway Prayers.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot of tunes about travel and cars and Richard Petty and stuff like that. So, you know, like leading up to it, people would ask me, "What's it called?" and stuff. And I'm like, "Well, I don't really know." But just a couple weeks ago, I was, you know, I'm collecting these songs. And like I said, I'm just letting the songs kind of lead me to where it goes.
Yeah.
I don't really know yet. So I start reading the songs and looking at the lyrics and I go, "Wait, well, this one's called this and this one's called that, and that's about travel, and there's two songs about a car, and then there's this." It's like, this is a song about cars and traveling and stuff.
Yeah.
Or a record about that, you know? So I'm just, like, kind of thinking about, well, what does it feel like to be on the highway, and what is music to me when I'm traveling?
Yeah.
It's medicine, you know?
Yeah.
I've listened to so much John Hartford on the road, and he's kept it between the lines for me.
Yeah.
You know? And I just wanted to make a record that is kind of something somebody can put on when they got an hour drive or more ahead of them.
Right.
And, you know, highway prayers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Beautiful.
Highway hymnals.
Yeah. I love it. So you want to try and play a song?
Yeah. Let's see. I got to think of one first.
Why don't you do one of those other Doc Watson ones?
Hell yeah. That's my bag. I'd love to do that.
All right. Let me try to work these mics out.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think that's gonna work. I think that's gonna work.
Hey. Well, all right.
Go for it.
Yeah, I'll do this little one learned from Doc Watson. It's called Brown's Ferry Blues.
Hard luck pup coming down the lane. Mama getting back his walking cane. Lord, Lord, I got them Brown's Ferry Blues. Well, he throwed it away and he went to town to see that woman and now he's down. Lord, Lord, I got them Brown's Ferry Blues.
Yes, fucking amazing, man.
Mm-hmm. Missed a few words there, but that's okay.
Thanks a lot, Billy. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, brother.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
How was that, folks? How was that? You can go to BillyStrings.com for his tour dates and ticket links. He's out there. Hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, for all you Full Marin subscribers, we closed out the WTF Origins series this week with a talk about the trial and error early days of doing the podcast.
I was surprised to go back to my emails and find that it was November. You know, we started September 1st, yeah. 2009, and already in November was when you had the deal to do a pilot presentation for Comedy Central. So it was just 2 months in. There was enough attention and interest in what the show was and what this idea was that you got a deal to put something together called WTF that would be for television.
Yeah, but
it
very quickly it had nothing to do with our podcast. And right. It was somehow I talked Chelsea Peretti into co-hosting with me, mm-hmm. and it was like a monologue, and then we did a segment on Freegans, and then we had a panel, and then some people brought paintings, and I don't remember, but it was more of a talk show.
It was probably what essentially became, if it had gotten picked up by Comedy Central, it would have been in the same orbit as like Tosh.0.
Right, but like I had no idea what we were doing. It was at that time where they gave you like $35,000 to pull together a presentation. I can't remember where we did it. Maybe at the Comedy Central space.
That was it. Yeah.
And it was sort of a disaster, and it didn't really have a rudder. You know, it was fairly traditional, but it was weird. To hear that episode and all of the WTF Origin episodes, plus new bonus shows twice a week, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Now I'm going to play guitar the way I do it. Not a wizard. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.